Hey, good morning. This is Tyler Don Rosenquist, and welcome to Character in Context, where we're not going to be talking about Bible context this week, because I am getting ready for the Founded in Truth Hanukkah conference, that I will actually be on my way driving to when this airs for the first time, and you might actually hear this 2 weeks if I don't get my Cyrus teaching done, which is our next installment in Isaiah and the Messiah. But this has been kind of a crazy week. Not only am I having to get two talks done, you know, on the PowerPoints and all that stuff. And I'm going to do part of the children's program, and I'm excited about that. I'm going to do it on the parable of the rower. And if you haven't heard me do that, I have a short blog post on my on theancientbridge.com where I talk about that. And yes, it is rower and not sower. it's a parable about the different kinds of people and how they represent our Messiah. But anyway, so next week I will be speaking in Charlotte, North Carolina, and I hope I'm going to see you there. I hope that you're there with me instead of listening to this, actually, because I would love to meet you guys. But this has been a weird week for me. I've got a dog going in for surgery tomorrow, and it seems like he maybe has decided that he is about to die, because he just got old this year, and he's had a good life, though. And my husband has strep throat, and so I had him home all day yesterday, which I'm not used to, but I gotta tell you, see, we've been married for almost 29 years, and he is not one of these man-cold big babies. He is actually really great when he's sick. The only problem with him when he's sick is he comes in the kitchen and he putters around, and I have to make him go away, because I just, no, stay out of my kitchen. I love my kitchen. But and then my kids also, who never get sick, they've also been under the weather. I guess that's what happens when all three of the men in your life work at the exact same place and people decide not to stay home when they're sick. There was just, and now I'm going, I went to the doctor yesterday with my husband, and when they gave him antibiotics, I begged for some just in case, you know, I start getting sick. So just in case it's over the weekend, I'm not going to be in trouble and not able to go to the conference. But anyway, so. By the time you hear this, it's too late to pray for me. I either got sick or I didn't. It's just the way it is, and that's the way it is this time of year, isn't it? Anyway, so I wanted to talk a little bit about Hanukkah, because like everything, you know, people who are messianics, Hebrew roots, quote-unquote Torah observant, and actually I ought to talk about that too, they sometimes, you know, we manufacture controversies in the Hebrew Roots movement. I mean, I'm sure you've noticed. I mean, we take things that nobody has issue with, and not even Orthodox Jews, okay, who are way stricter than us when it comes to Torah observance, when it comes to what does and does not constitute idolatry and all that. And we just come up with the wacky, you know, really wacky things, like saying that if you have this word in the Bible, you know, that's a Hebrew word, and then if you translate it into English, all of a sudden, if that English word is what was chosen to translate something that in the Bible is bad, that all of a sudden now that English word is pagan or something. It's just we come up with these things that it's like we're just itching to denounce and decry absolutely everything. And even at the expense of, I'm sorry, the truth sometimes. And, you know, Hanukkah gets attacked on some really crazy kinds of issues because we do not understand how things worked in the ancient world. And one of the things that we do not understand is the importance of a shared meal and shared fellowship, and the importance of commemorating and honoring great acts of God, even when they occurred outside of the biblical record. or they occurred not in the Torah, and they weren't specifically commanded by God to be remembered. But, you know, one of the most repeated words in Scripture is actually zikar, and it means to remember, and we're constantly commanded to remember the deliverances that God has done for us, and not only historically, and this is where we kind of get into a problem, where there are people who act like the only things that we're allowed to remember and celebrate and commemorate and honor God for are things that were in the Torah. But as we talked about in Isaiah and the Messiah part six last week, the Lord he's about to do a new thing. He's saying, forget everything in the past. He's not really saying forget everything in the past. What he's saying is, you know, forget everything that you know and that the ways that you think I act. I'm going to deliver you again, only I'm going to do it in entirely a new and an unexpected way. You know, specifically by using a pagan Gentile who doesn't worship Yahweh, never worshipped Yahweh, and never in his life worshipped Yahweh. Yahweh's going to use him as his mode of salvation for his people to take them, to deliver them out of Babylon and back into the land. And it's also looking into a future. You know, when Yahweh does things, the only thing that Yahweh's confined by is his promises to Israel. He's made promises to Israel, and he has to honor them because that's his character, but he can honor those promises any way he wants. Saying that he can't, saying that he can only do what's already written in Scripture is actually a pagan concept that we've been talking about called the law of continuity. It's saying that Yahweh is bound, that Yahweh is a prisoner of the Torah and the prophets. But that can't possibly be true and have him still be God. Now, he will never forsake Israel. And that is in there. Those are the kind of things that define him, because he said that there are things he will and will not do. Okay? And those are promises that he will keep. But how he keeps those promises, that's entirely up to him. And as he says in Isaiah over and over and over again, behold, I am doing a new thing, something that no one has ever talked about, no one has foreseen, no one has even imagined. I mean, you're not going to find Cyrus, you know, mentioned before Isaiah, and then all of a sudden, wham, this is God's chosen way of deliverance. There were people, and you can tell by the way Isaiah's written, there are people who are objecting, no, you can't rescue us that way. That's a filthy, pagan, Gentile, idol worshiper. You can't do it. You've got to raise up someone from among us again. You've got to pull another Moses. Well, you know, we need to remember that, and here I am talking about Isaiah and the Messiah, and I said I was going to talk about other things. This is what happens when I go without an outline. You know, this is just what it is. But remember, Moses wasn't always approved of either. I'm sorry, he wasn't raised among them. The palace brat? Sure, he went back and defended them and sided with them and that sort of thing, but he wasn't ever one of them. And he knew it. And when Yahweh called me, says, whoa, how are they going to even believe, you know, that you've sent me, that I'm one of them, all that sort of thing. There's just no way. They're not going to accept me. And so Yahweh finally runs and says, you know what? Fine. Aaron, he's one of them. He can be your mouthpiece, but you're the guy. I've chosen you. Doesn't matter if they're offended. It doesn't matter if they want to believe you. You're going to do things that are for me that are going to force them to believe you. And that's what happened. And Cyrus, the same way, he did the things that Yahweh said through the prophet that he would do to free them and send them back to the land. in a time where return from exile was considered impossible, wasn't something you could do because no nation had ever been restored from exile. And of course, according to the heathen law of continuity, which counted gods as captives of the system just as much as humans were, they were part of the system, they weren't above it, they weren't the ones that created the system, they were part of the system, so they couldn't, I want to say violate the rules of it, that's not right, but they didn't operate with independent authority from the system. There we go. There was only so much they could do. They couldn't change the system. They could only operate within it. Yahweh can change the system if he wants, and Yahweh sometimes does change the system because he created the system. The system is his. That's why he can take a man born without eyes, which is, you know, what I believe happened, and he can give him eyes and make him see. You know, you'll see it in certain Midrashic literature that some of the rabbis believe that Sarah was actually born without a uterus, and she had never in her life menstruated. Now, I don't believe that's probably true, because it would have been weird for her to get married if that was true, because they waited for menstruation for a woman to be, for a girl to be old enough to marry. It was considered a sign. But what if she was born without a uterus? Is that beyond Yahweh? I mean, does he have to operate within a system that says, you know, you've got what you've got, and you can heal what she's got, and but if she doesn't have it, you couldn't. So that's the pagan gods. They had to work with what they had. Yahweh's not like that. That old Men in Black movie says, we are outside the system, we are above it. We are the Men in Black. Well, Yahweh is the God. He created the system. He's outside the system. He's above the system. He can do whatever he wants. Sometimes we forget that. And which has absolutely nothing to do with Hanukkah, but does have to do with Cyrus. And so we've got the return from exile. But then we've got, let's talk about Purim, because Purim's coming up in a few months. And Yahweh does something entirely different in a book that doesn't even mention him. You know, Esther is very controversial because it doesn't mention Yahweh anywhere, and yet his fingerprints are all over the book. He's obviously the one pulling the strings behind the scene. And here you have a great deliverance of the Jews long after the time of Cyrus, generations after the time of Cyrus, when it was, you know, ruled by some of the last rulers of the, what they call it, the Achaemenid Empire, which is why everybody calls it the Medo-Persian Empire, because nobody likes to say Achaemenid. And, you know, the Jews were almost annihilated. And so what do they do? What is appropriate to do in the ancient world when there's been a great deliverance? Well, what they would do is they would have a feast. I mean, you know, they only had so many things they could do. And so you have a feast. It wasn't a feast that was held apart from God. It was a feast, and it was obviously honoring the deliverance that God had worked in their lives. You see, table and fellowship in the ancient world is a sacred thing. We just don't get it because food is plentiful. We see our food is coming from the grocery store, and this is actually one of the things that I'm going to be talking about at Hanukkah in North Carolina is the ministry of Yeshua. You might know him as Jesus. As far as table fellowship goes and how it shows him to be the divine Son of God, because, you know what, I'm not going to do this because that talk is like 50 minutes long. And so if I start talking about it, I'm either going to totally not do it justice, or I'm, I'm going to run out of time and not say what I meant to say here. But in the ancient world, the greatest way you can honor someone is throwing a feast in their honor. They don't just look at it as some kind of party you had independent of God. No, everything about the party is a remembrance of some great thing that God has done. And so he is the guest of honor at any feast. And that wouldn't have been any different at Purim. They had a great victory. And so after they had a great feast after that, every year, Esther commanded that they commemorate the deliverance. Now, this wasn't like our modern 4th of July, where we're just going, yay, we're not British anymore and we have better food. Okay, sorry, guys. Come on, my British friends. You know it's true. Gordon Ramsay, you know, aside, you know it's true. But, you know, and my British friends call it Happy Treason Day. But, you know, we have some of our holidays in the United States are independent of God, and some are not. Thanksgiving was originally a feast in God's honor to thank him for the deliverance. And if you have never read the... Oh, now I can't remember the name of the book. Don't worry about it. But if you've never read the true story about what happened when the pilgrims first came over and how difficult it was for them to survive, you know why they were having a feast in God's honor and why they continued to celebrate it every year. Not as a replacement of anything, but as a legitimate and a joyful acknowledgement of God's abundant provision. And see, ancient people totally got this. We don't. We don't understand it, and so we look at anything not in, you know, the Torah, and we say, oh, pagan, ways of the nations. No, not sometimes, not always. So we have Purim, and Purim is celebration of deliverance. You know, oh gosh, here's one. Here's one that people forget about. The Torah specifically says that Abraham had a great feast when Isaac was weaned. Whoa! That's not commanded in Scripture. It's not. And yet, you know, is there anything presented wrong about it? No, he finally had a son. His son was finally weaned, okay, which marked the passing out of the dangerous years when children were most likely to die. You know, the first few years of life in the ancient world were very treacherous. And he had a celebration to honor that. Is that pagan? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And in the same way, we've got Hanukkah. And of course, there are myths and silly things tied to Hanukkah over the years since it was first instituted, but we can't use that to judge the basic celebration and the intent of the basic celebration, which was set up to be, well, the original, let's talk about the original Feast of Dedication, and Hanukkah is what was celebrated afterwards, okay? Feast of Dedication. They had been cut off from the temple, which had been defiled for a number of years. And they'd been being slaughtered by the Seleucid Greeks, which were the Greeks who were ruling Asia Minor and some of what we call the Near East, all right? And then you got the Ptolemies in Egypt. But of course, there was these horrible years where the Greeks came in and they defiled the temple. They sacrificed a pig on the altar. They did horrible things. They built the Acra, which was a fortress designed to keep out the Jews from their own temple. And it was a terrible time. And during this time, they couldn't celebrate Passover because they were blocked off from the temple. They couldn't celebrate Shavuot, Pentecost, because they were blocked off from the temple. And what's more, they were blocked off from their land anymore. Anyway, they couldn't farm, which meant that they couldn't, they had no crops to present at Shavuot, at Pentecost, and they had no animals to sacrifice. They couldn't do any of these things, and they couldn't do Tishri 1, Yom Teruah, or Rosh Hashanah, whichever you call it. They couldn't do Yom Kippur. They couldn't do Sukkot. And so here, the temple is finally cleansed in the month of Kislev. Of course, Sukkot was celebrated in the seventh month, and Kislev is the ninth month. And they hadn't been able to throw Yahweh any of his festivals for years. So what do they do in recognition of his great deliverance? So they say, well, there's nothing written in Scripture that authorizes us to do anything, and so we have to wait until Passover. No, that's not an ancient mindset. That's not a Hebraic mindset. You don't wait to honor your God until, you know, there's a completely unrelated festival in, what, 3 months. You don't do that. You honor God now. And so what they did was they celebrated a Sukkot-ish festival in the same blueprint. And to this day, when Jews meet in the synagogues for Hanukkah, what they do is they read large portions of the Sukkot liturgy from that festival. But everyone knows it's not the same. So they had a celebration to honor God, to honor his place of worship, because that is what you did to honor your God in the ancient world. You had a celebration in their honor to show the world how great your God was. So the original Hanukkah was saying, hey, look, our God's not defeated, just like he wasn't by the Babylonians. Here he's not defeated again. We have routed the encroachers. They're out. They're defeated. They're not coming back. The temple of our God is not destroyed. It's been cleansed. It's been reconstituted. No pig will ever be, you know, sacrificed on this altar again. Unclean people won't be, you know, be trampling it again. The Gentiles won't be trampling the courts again. This is done. And we're proving it by boldly holding an 8-day festival in his honor. And it was the 8-day festival that was the inspiration behind the creation of the Hanukkah, which is an 8 lighted menorah. And I know some people say, oh, there's only one menorah. No, menorah is just a word that means lamp. There's the menorah in the temple. In the second temple, there was the menorah. In Solomon's temple, there were like, what, 9? There was the big one, and then there were other ones because the whole place was just lit up like crazy. But in the second temple, there was only, as far as I know, ever one menorah. But the Hanukkah was not meant to be that. And the funny thing was, Hillel and Shammai, the first century BCE, before Yeshua, they were arguing about whether you light the candles right to left or left to right. And they had a big argument about it. Of course, Hillel won. But it's silly. You know, it's kind of like, really, guys? Come on. We got more important things to be discussing and arguing about. But it wasn't known as, and it was even, actually, it was in Josephus's time, known as the Festival of Lights. But the whole thing about the miracle of the oil and all that to explain the whole Festival of Lights thing, that was a long time later. That is medieval, legendary material, and I know a lot of people take it seriously, but it's just, you know, it's just one of those cool little stories that people add on to the tradition. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how not all traditions are bad, and how, unfortunately, a misinterpretation of what Yeshua is saying, and I'm going to recommend a great book to you too, has really muddied the waters in all this, and we've got to kind of back off and really consider that we're what we're saying. Anyway, we will be back in a second. Okay, so this is Tyler Don Rosenquist, and we are back with special Hanukkah-ish character and context for this week. I'm in North Carolina as you're hearing this. So I have to record, and since I'm at a Hanukkah conference, I figure I better talk about Hanukkah. And in the last half, we had just started talking about how it is acceptable to have non-biblical celebrations in honor of God because of the ancient mindset, because of how they used to look at feast, and we really still should, how when Abraham had a feast, and when Isaac was weaned, there was nothing wrong with that. We celebrate God's gifts, and he is always, if we're doing it right, the guest of honor. He is the one we're celebrating when we do have a feast commemorating an event. And the original pilgrims understood this when they had Thanksgiving, and it wasn't about football back then. It still isn't at my house. But so we get people get this funny idea, and I'm going to recommend a book that Yeshua talks about traditions of men. And so people who, unfortunately, there are some teachers who really promote this idea, take off my headphones here, that anything you do not see in the Torah commanded by God is a tradition of men. So right there we have Abraham is a transgressor because he had a feast for Isaac's weaning. Esther is a transgressor for setting up Purim, and there are actually a lot of people who say she is. The Hasmoneans were sinners for setting up the memorial feast of Hanukkah after the first Hanukkah, because they're not commanded by the Bible, and we are not allowed to ever celebrate God's deliverances and the amazing things God's done, except for three times a year, because why? Why? Why are we limited in our expressions of gratitude? When we really think of it, it's almost like this grudging thing. Well, okay, God, I'll do your feasts, but that's it. Otherwise, every day is just a normal day and you're not getting any special treatment from me. I am not going to celebrate you when we have a new baby. I'm not going to celebrate you when you make it possible for me or my spouse to get a new job. I'm not going to celebrate you when our child graduates from high school or college. Just, we're not celebrating anything except Passover and Shavuot and Yom Teruah and Yom Kippur and Sukkot. That's it. Those are the only days of the year we're going to rejoice, because we are just not joyful people, and that's not one of the fruits of the Spirit or anything. What did Paul said? Weep with those who weep and rejoice with those who rejoice. We are commanded to rejoice. We have a lot to celebrate. And every celebration should be centered around what God has given us. Absolutely. It is not wrong to have extra celebrations, okay? It's not inherently pagan. It's inherently grateful, okay? It's gratitude. Anyway, so Yeshua talked about traditions of men, and I want you to get onto Amazon.com or wherever, but I know they sell them on Amazon, and look for a book by Dr. Halissa Aylwine. She's one of the most educated teachers in the Messianic Hebrew Roots Torah Pursuant Movement, all right? She's a PhD. She is very brilliant, and she wrote a book called, I think it's these three words in some order, Truth, Terror, or Tradition. Okay? And it talks about, and her PhD is in this stuff, okay? She didn't get a PhD in, like, art history, and then she's teaching about this. This is her field. She talks about the difference between what is in the Torah, what is a terror, what is bad, and what is merely a tradition that aids with worship. Because, you know, Yeshua, actually, we see him in, I think it's in John 10, he is at Hanukkah. And that is not a fun trip to make in the middle of winter in ancient Israel. Okay, he would have been traveling from Capernaum to Jerusalem, and the roads were yucky, and the wadis were full, because that was the time of the early rains, not the latter rains. People get that wrong. The early rains were in the winter, and the latter rains were in the spring, because it was run by the agricultural year, not by the festival year. But Yeshua was at Hanukkah. Okay, without Hanukkah, there would be no Yeshua. And it is a celebration of the restoration of the temple. It's very important. So he was there. But Yeshua also kept other traditions. He very clearly spoke Baracha, the blessing over bread and wine. Okay? It says, and he spoke the blessing and he broke the bread. And you see that several times. Well, that's the Baracha. And it's not commanded in the Torah. So is it pagan to do that? Is it pagan to say, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, I can't remember in Hebrew, but blessed are you, O Lord our God, who brings forth bread from the earth and the one over the wine. Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam, Borei Pari Hagafen, who brings forth the fruit of the vine. That brings a gratitude to God and a celebration of God into every single meal where bread and wine are eaten. It's not in the Torah. It's not anywhere. It's not commanded. But Yeshua was doing it. Everyone was doing it. It's a good thing to do. Also, we see a reference in Acts to the Sabbath day journey. Well, in the Mishnah and Tractate Eruvin, they have these convoluted and sometimes crazy rules about how far you can go on the Sabbath, but this was a known thing, and in those days it was hot, and you wouldn't want to travel all that far from where you were on the Sabbath. Wouldn't be enormously restful, and in those days they didn't really have synagogues, and they certainly didn't have transportation. They couldn't get in the car and go, so they had to walk, and they would generally walk to the courtyard of someone else's dwelling and meet, and someone would read or recite from memory from the Torah, and maybe the Haftarah. Of course, the Torah portions hadn't been invented yet, and there's another one. Torah portions, that's a tradition. Is that wrong? They're certainly not commanded in Scripture. Scripture says, read the Torah every 7 years. Communities didn't have Torah scrolls. That was the only time they would hear the Torah, once every 7 years, at the fall feast, okay? So are the Torah portions a bad idea? No. They're a bad idea when you focus on them only and you never crack open the Gospels again. That's a bad idea, and I've seen a lot of people do that, and they get completely dissociated from the Savior. And his teachings, which were the Torah in spirit and truth, Torah on steroids, Torah as it always should have been taught. Trying to think of, because there are a few others that Yeshua kept. Yeshua only objected to, because we're talking about the two times, let's see, in Mark 7 and I think it's Luke 11, 38. We're in Mark, like, 7, verses 1 through 14. I could be getting that totally wrong. But where, in Mark, the disciples are challenged because they're not doing the ritual hand washing that had recently come into vogue over the past 100 years or so from that time. And in Luke, they're actually taking Yeshua to task for not doing the ritual hand washing. And they say, well, why are you guys violating the tradition of the elders and not washing your hands before, you know, eating bread? And Yeshua doesn't even answer them because, you know, he used to do that, right? He's just not even, it's like, well, we're not going to talk about what you're trying to talk about here. We're going to talk about the real issue here. And he said, you have a fine way of setting aside the commandments of God in order to observe your traditions. Now, did he say hand washing is evil? No, he didn't. What he did say later is that their belief, their practice that was predicated around the idea that you could defile common food. And we're not talking about temple food here. We're talking about common, normal, everyday, fine food, not holy food, that you could defile them with unwashed hands was ridiculous. Okay, but that is what they were teaching in those times. And we talked about that back in the woes. We were talking about the cups and plates teaching. So if you want to go back and you want to talk, that was this spring or this summer we were talking about that. But he was saying that he called them, he didn't call them on the hand washing. He didn't even, you know, he didn't even say there was anything wrong with doing it. All you moms are going, whew, because I want my kids to wash their hands. Well, they weren't washing, they were just pouring water. It wasn't enormously more sanitary than not washing your hands, but it was some. It was at least something. It is probably all your kids do is when they go into the bathroom and you're not there, is they kind of just, maybe they don't even put their hands under, I don't know. But the Pharisees were. The Pharisees definitely were getting their hands wet. But he says, you have a fine way of setting aside the commandments of God. You know, and what was he talking about? He was talking about some of the really awful laws that they had set up to subvert God's commandments. There was specifically this law was just terrible. What is one of the most important of the Ten Commandments? Honor your father and mother so that it will go well with you in the land that you are receiving. Okay, so people were supposed to treat their parents with honor. They were supposed to make sure that they were taken care of in their old age, and especially in first century Roman occupied Palestine, because starvation and disease, and it was all horrifying and it was just rampant. All right? It was a nightmare. You know, in a time when 72% of people never made it past their 16th birthday, it wasn't fun to be old either. And most people, by the time they reached adulthood, one of their parents was already dead. It's just crazy. And so they had developed this rule which gave them the ability to set aside unspecified, well, I dedicate an animal to the temple. And your parents come to you, or to the priest, or whatever. It could be a haggadah, a personal offering. Or it could have been offering, you know, to set it apart to the Levites, the priest. And so your parents come to you and say, you know, son, we're hungry. We're really in need of support. Oh, I am so sorry. I specified an animal to the Lord, and until he shows me which one it is, or I actually take one and do the sacrifice, well, I can't give you anything until I fulfill my vow. And it is months before I can get to Jerusalem. And so I just can't help you. I wish I could do something, but I just can't. Okay? So this rule is a tradition. It is and like I said, traditions aren't necessarily wrong, but a tradition that oppresses somebody is contrary to the heart of everything that is in the Torah. And you can't use this lesser interpretation of a law that's being totally exploited here, because it doesn't say that if you make a vow to God that you cannot do anything with your animals. It just says you have to fulfill your vow. But they twisted it in order to give themselves an out so that they didn't have to give, because giving away an animal, even to your parents, was giving away a sizable amount of wealth, because their wealth was in agriculture. Their wealth was in animals. Their wealth was in crops. These weren't people who had money laying around. They were people who had animals and crops. That's the ancient world. That is how people stored their wealth. You had wealth, you bought more animals. You know, and because animals weren't for food, by and large. That's why the feasts were such a big deal. Animals weren't for food. Animals were for wool or hair and milk. That was the value in an animal. And when they were dead, you know, the hide. But they weren't for eating. I mean, the males were, you know, more for eating than the females, obviously, because you only need, you know, you only need like a few males. The females are the valuable animals. So the males, you know, you can shear them, yes, but you have to feed them. So if you're going to eat anything, it's pretty much going to be a male animal because they were expendable. Sorry, guys, you know, but fortunately humans are not, you know, on the menu. So you don't have to worry. We ladies love you. We do. We do. You're very valuable to us. But in the animal world, you are not nearly as valuable. But yeah, they developed this horrible law, which was just very cruel, very callous. And I know in our society today, you're just going like, oh my gosh, that is not right. And yet, you know, we shouldn't judge, because I know believing families where the parents get sick, the parents come into poverty, and all the sons, sorry guys, they just step aside. And I mean, I've got a friend right now, and she's I call her my twin. Okay. We don't look anything alike. We don't even vote anything alike, but I just love her. And her mother is 94 years old. She's got dementia, and she's got brothers. Okay. But they're not lifting a finger. They're not sending any money. They're not doing anything. She had to create a home-based business on top of working a full-time job to support her mom and to get her the care she needs. All right? Because she has to work. So someone's got to be with mom. So she's got to hire people. And it's not that it's not that brothers can't help. It's just that in this society, there is this hands-off kind of attitude where a lot of times sons do not help. And it is left to female, and who, you know, frankly, do get paid less than guys. And in this case, unmarried. And she's left holding the bag for care. So it's really not that different. We do this kind of things in these days. We have our own traditions that, you know, parents get taken care of by the daughters, and especially by the unmarried daughters. It's not right. It's not just. It's not reasonable. But it is true. And I'm not saying it's true in every family. Obviously, it's not true in every family. And so here we've got a tradition in the form of an interpretation that is oppressive. Okay? Whenever Yeshua would talk about whenever he would take issue with the Pharisees, it was never on their keeping of the Torah. It was on their interpretations of the Torah and kind of the weight they gave to certain commandments over others. And so that's, you know, when he was criticizing traditions of men, that's what he was criticizing. He's not saying there's anything wrong with lighting candles on the Sabbath with with having chicken on Friday night, which I rarely do, but, you know, it's her tradition. Those are harmless things. Those are community things. You know, community rituals bind people together. When we do the same things in the same ways, it gives us a sense of community. That's not wrong. That's not awful. It's just something that people do. So, you know, big deal. But when people are using a tradition, an interpretation to harm other people, that was always something Yeshua stood against. Like the Hillelite tradition as opposed to the Shammai, which said that you could interpret the divorce laws in Deuteronomy 24, I think, to say that anything a woman does to displease you, you can divorce her over. And if she burns a meal, and Rabbi Akiva said, even if you find somebody prettier, and, you know, no one's pretty forever except Sarah, I guess, and Rebecca. But that's the kind of stuff Yeshua always stood against. Traditions of men, traditional interpretations that oppressed other people. Hanukkah obviously does not fall into that category, nor do most interpretations. Most interpretations of the Torah do not oppress anyone. Any interpretations that do are a tradition of men. And there are actually quite a few interpretations that I see people adhering to now that that do oppress other people. And I'm not going to go into them right now. But, oh my gosh, we've only got 4 minutes left. I talked about that a lot longer. Gee, I'm long-winded. Talked about that a lot longer than I thought. I'm going to just whammy you at the end with something I've wanted to talk about for a long time. You know, we have this myth. We have this phrase that's a myth. It's called Torah observant. Okay? But Torah observant is a myth because there's an awful lot of the Torah laws that we don't keep now, and we wouldn't keep now if we could. Like, I don't know anyone who would sell themselves into slavery instead of declaring bankruptcy. So if you would declare bankruptcy instead of selling yourself and your family to your creditors, just don't talk about being Torah observant as opposed to, you know, those lawless people who don't keep as much as I do. We have this strange thing where we only have people say, oh, Christians are lawless. Well, you know, Christians keep like 50. There's this guy, and he did this awesome study, and I can't remember what his name is. He's a rabbi, David Friedman. He's down in Southern California. I've talked to him on the phone. Nice guy. And he did an article, said the Mosaic Law is not as divisive as you would think. And he did a thing, and mainstream Christians keep 58% of the commandments that can currently be kept. And Messianics and Hebrew Roots people only keep about 8% more. That's right. Only 8% more. That is kind of crazy. And so people, when they're calling Christians lawless, they're saying the 58% of the Torah that they keep and that's important to them and they fight for and they even legislate, well, that doesn't count. They're lawless because they don't keep this other 8%. They don't do the right parties. They don't do the Sabbath on the right day. They don't celebrate the feasts. They do, except Pentecost. And a lot of them are celebrating Passover now. Their diet isn't what we would consider kosher, even though the stuff that we consider kosher is not what a Jew would consider. They would see us as lawless by our own standards. And they don't wear tzitzit. And they don't have the mezuzah on the door. And when we say that we're Torah observant, they're not. What we're saying is the only commandments that count as Torah observant are the feast, is the Sabbath, is eating cleaner, is wearing tzitzit and having the mezuzah on the door. And all those other commandments, no. You can keep them, but you're still lawless. Like, they don't even count. Well, that's an insult to all the commandments they are keeping. The majority. And we're only keeping a few more. We can't say that those ones count. Or they could turn around and say, you know, how many hospitals have you built lately? How many orphans are you supporting? You know, what are you doing? How many missionaries are you supporting? And a lot of people who claim to keep the Torah would have to say, well, none. Well, that's commanded too. That's commandment. Well, we take care of the oppressed. Yeshua's last commandment was that we spread the gospel. And I know one Torah observant missionary, and he cannot, Torah observant, I used it. I know one Hebrew Roots, quotish, Torah pursuant missionary, and he can't get support. He can't scrape together enough support where he can stay with his family all year. He has to fish in Alaska all summer every year just to keep his missionary work going, and he does it gladly, but he shouldn't have to. Anyway, so just consider this whole Torah observant thing. No, because unless you're willing to sell yourself into slavery, unless you're a barren woman who's going to marry your brother, if, you know, you don't provide your husband with kids before he dies, don't call yourself Torah observant and call other people lawless. Anyway, I'll see you next week, or this one will be airing again later.